Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for joining me today, wherever you're listening. I love doing these podcasts, and I hope you enjoy listening to them too. This podcast is sponsored by Cooker, 100-degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Best gadget ever. Tea, immediately. Veg, boiled, immediately. Veg, steamed, immediately. Pasta, potatoes, and rice, boiled, immediately. Also, filtered water and filtered sparkling water from the very same tap. Incredible piece of kit. I love mine. For more information, go to cooker.co.uk. Cooker spelled Q-U-O-O-K-E-R. Today's podcast is a celebrity special. 19 questions to James Acaster. And if I like his answers, he gets the bonus 20th question. Well, I mean, I say 19 questions. I didn't get through all 19 either with Connie Huck or Fran Healy. I think that's because I talk too much. And, you know, the guests I choose, they talk a lot too. So maybe it's their fault too. I like to keep the podcast around an hour or so. I think that an hour mark is a good sort of time for one of these podcasts. So what I do is when I'm going along, I have to cut some of the questions out as I'm looking through them, because I'm thinking, oh, we're going to go over an hour here. So maybe I'll try and be a little bit more disciplined today. I'm a big fan of James Acaster. He's different. He's a great comic. I get to interview a lot of comics, and I always enjoy their company. Comedians are good fun. They're a good laugh, and I love having them guests on my TV show and also this podcast, because they're just, you know, they always got something funny to say and they're interesting people. James Acaster, he stands out a bit. His act is a little bit different from the norm. That's what I've always thought. I've always thought he's, you know, just a bit different from a lot of the other guys. He's got a slightly more eccentric act. I love it. I think he's a really funny guy. I read this from Wiki, actually. Acaster previously played drums in various local bands in Northamptonshire, including the Wow Scenario. When Acaster was a member of Capri Sun Quartet, he was known as Sir William Strawberry. After the Wow Scenario broke up, he decided to do comedy. I have no idea what that means. I'm going to do comedy now. I assume that means he's going to be a stand-up. Anyway, let's find out. Let's meet him. It's James Acaster. Hi, James. How are you?
Good, thank you, Tim. How are you today?
But you know what? I'm really well. We're in lockdown, and this time I've got more of a handle on it. I'm doing more podcasting, and I'm sort of getting my head around it a bit more. How are you finding lockdown, James?
Yeah, good, thank you. I maybe, there's certain elements of it I prefer. There's certain things I miss from the real world. But yeah, in general, I'm glad we're doing it. I think it's the right thing to be doing at the moment. Hopefully, it'll be for the best.
I read this thing out from your Wiki because I'm lazy, and
yes,
you know, I could have done lots of research on you, but I just, because sure, I know you quite well, you've been on the show so many times, Sunday Brunch, I just thought I'd just go to Wikipedia, and it just says this bit at the end where when the Wow Scenario broke up, you decided to do comedy. Did that mean that you just decided, right, I'm going to be a stand-up comedian, or had you already been doing that?
I had done a few gigs before. So when I was 21, I did my first ever gig because I had a bit of a, I had a few years where I was like trying to like tick off things off the old bucket list, even though I was quite young. I'd had a car crash and that really scared me. And so I was doing loads of things that were like, I did a skydive and stuff like that. And I started doing volunteer work. And then that led, weirdly, it's a very long story, but it led to doing my first stand-up gig. And I enjoyed it. And I just did it just for the, you know, tick it off, I've done stand-up. And then every now and again, I'd do a stand-up gig. Just for my own amusement. So I probably did about 3 or 4 a year for about 3 years or something like that. And then when the band split up, I didn't go to university or anything. I didn't have qualifications to fall back on. And I didn't really have any other skills that were transferred, you know, any other arenas. But I'd done stand up. I couldn't be bothered to form another band because, like, that's a lot of work getting, you know, finding people to be in a band with you and getting them all to band practice and getting them all to gigs. So I thought, in the meantime, while I make my mind up for what I'm going to do in my life, I'll do stand-up because I can do that on my own. I can travel, you know, previously I've been traveling around the country with a drum kit, so now I can just travel around on my own. That's so much easier. and comedy gigs, people were at least sitting there and listening to you, even if it was only five or six people. They were all sitting on chairs and facing you and listening, whereas music gigs, no one was listening to us. They'd be like watching the TV in the corner of the pub or something like that, talking over the music. So even though stand-up, you know, I was a lot worse at stand-up than I was at playing the drums, didn't know what I was doing, found it very difficult. It wasn't, the gigs weren't as bad and demeaning as the music gigs I've been doing. And traveling around was a lot easier than traveling around with a band. So it meant that I kind of got carried away with it and it became what I wanted to do.
But weren't you terrified the first time you got on stage? I can't think of anything worse than standing up on a stage and trying to make people laugh. It just, the thought of it terrifies me.
You know what? For years, I was in denial about how much it scared me. And I think because that was the only way I could do it. So when my first ever stand-up gig, I literally pretended all day long that I wasn't doing it, that I wasn't doing a gig that night, and that I was just going to a gig. And I didn't let myself even engage with the fear of it. So I pushed it out of my mind all day. And then when I was walking up to the stage, when they said my name and I had to walk on stage, then my heart was like bursting out of my chest and my brain was telling me, just walk out the door. Because there was the stage. The stage was next to the front door, the exit of the pub. So literally, I could have just like, with just like one step to the side, just walked out the door and left, which would have been pretty funny, to be fair. But I didn't do that. And then for years, I just told myself that I wasn't scared and stand-up didn't make me nervous. And anytime anyone asked me, you know, oh, that must be really nerve-wracking, I'd say, no, I like it. I'm excited to go on stage every night. And I just spoke like that all the time. And it really wasn't until, you know, recent years where I started admitting, oh, actually, this is nerve-wracking. I do find it scary. And maybe I need to start acknowledging what it does to my body getting on stage every night, because it doesn't always feel great, especially if you're lying to yourself and you're not letting yourself engage with the, you know, the surge of adrenaline or whatever. You're just ignoring that and labeling it as excitement rather than nerves. For a long time I pretend I wasn't scared, but I was scared too.
All right, let's get on with these questions then. I've got 19 of them. I've sent them to you. I just said to you, have you had a chance to look over them? And you said, no, I didn't bother. So this could go anywhere, but let's try and get through them. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life, James?
Maybe I should have read the questions. This is a big question straight away. What piece of advice would I give people? I do you know what? It's hard, isn't it, to me, for what's been invaluable to your life. In stand-up, there's loads of advice people have given me. Like Josie Long told me when I started out to just try and experiment with as many things as possible while you're an open spot before anyone can judge you. And that was invaluable. I did that, you know, when I was, every gig I did on the open mic circuit, I tried something different, completely different personas, completely different styles of comedy, just to try and find my voice. And that was really, really useful. So I always appreciate what she told me there. In life in general, I mean, it's weird because I was right, I had a Christian upbringing. So there's a lot of advice in that. But then I've since kind of come to kind of, well, I'm not religious anymore. And some of the advice you get given in Christianity, some of it's good, but some of it is not so good. Like one of the big ones that people always talk about is treat others the way you would want to be treated.
Yeah.
And that's a big one. And people always, and a lot of people fly the flag for that. But personally, I don't think that works because the way you want to be treated is not how everyone wants to be treated. It's ridiculous because your life, you've got a different life experience to other people. So some people are like, well, yeah, I can make fun of that person. I wouldn't mind being made fun of. It's like, yeah, they're not you, mate. So don't do. And also, they've had different life experience to you. So maybe don't joke about that kind of stuff because you haven't had to put up with that stuff, so you don't care, but they do. So I'd say my advice, treat others the way they want to be treated. How's that sound? That is the advice I would give people, is treat others the way they want to be treated. Brilliant. Stop making it all about yourself. That's why you can't understand people.
All right, next question. What does success mean to you?
Just being satisfied with whatever it is you've put out there. So it's not, you've got to measure success by your own standards and not other people's. So I would say, as soon as, like, if I've made, you know, so like in my line of work, if I've made something that I would want to see myself, I would go and see that stand-up show, I'd listen to that podcast, whatever it is, read that book, then that's success. and getting it out into the world actually as well. You know, I wouldn't want to make it and then just keep it to myself and no one else sees it. So as long as I get to release it on some kind of platform and it's something that I myself would go and see, great.
Going back to Josie, how long was it before you actually went on stage and thought, this is it, this is who I am, and this is the act, this is going to make people laugh?
Well, it's because it's weird, it's an ever-changing thing. I think a year and a half into doing stand-up, so it wasn't my job yet, but I was doing the open mic circuit. About a year and a half in, I was like, I realised I wanted it to be my job. So that's like, you know, I'd found something there. 2 years in, which is when I went on tour with Josie, I felt like I knew who I was a bit more as a comic, but I think really, maybe 2012, so I've been doing it for about 4 years. It was already been my job for about 2 years at that point. But that's when I kind of started to like find, oh, here's what I want to talk about. And I'd done my debut Edinburgh show the year before. And that debut show taught me what I didn't want to do. Like, you know, there were some bits in the show that I liked. I had a long routine about a cheese grater in that show. It lasted about 4 or 5 minutes. And I really loved that routine. But then I had other routines which were a bit different to that, maybe longer, more kind of like improvised routines or involving the audience and stuff like that, that I didn't like as much, or long stories, like real life stories about myself. And I decided I didn't want to do that as stand-up. What I wanted to do is that cheese grater bit. And so my 2012 show was just basically, you know, that routine as many times as I could do it, like about different subjects.
Do you think they fast track comics too much? I'll say why, because on Sunday Brunch, I sometimes get comics on there. And I was just saying in my intro, you're very different. The first time you ever came on Sunday Brunch, I remember going to I didn't really know who you were, and you'd came on Sunday Brunch. And afterwards I went to the producers, this guy's really different. He's special. Because a lot of comics have the same way of dealing with live TV. You were very different with it. And then I'm getting a lot of comics on recently, and you think, oh, you need to do the circuit a bit because you're good, but you just quite haven't honed it enough. Do you think they're fast-tracking too many comics at the moment?
No, I think we all get fast-tracked to some degree. Also, as a comedian, you have to do so many different things, you know. So live television is just one element of, like, you know, you've got to do live comedy, you've got to do podcasts, you might be asked to do books, to do festivals as well. So it's like you're doing so many different things, and there can be a comic who will absolutely destroy Edinburgh every year but wouldn't work so well on Sunday Brunch, and that doesn't mean they're being fast tracked to their bad comedian.
Okay.
I think it just means that they're not suited to that environment as much. Sometimes people can get fast tracked, but to be fair, I think the fast tracking helps you. I feel like I got a lot of opportunities before I was ready for them, but it helped me learn. Like that debut Edinburgh show, I wasn't really ready to do an Edinburgh show yet, but what it taught me was invaluable, and it made me a better comedian. So for us, it's great. Maybe for the audience, not always so much.
Do you like doing live TV?
Yeah, I do actually. Yeah. And as long as it's chaotic. I like doing Sunday Brunch, and there's a bunch of other shows as well that are live where they let you you know, go off the leash a little bit. You don't always have to, you know. Sometimes live TV, you get people who try and make it like a pre-recorded show.
Yeah.
And like, come on, this has to be tight. It's like, well, why don't we just pre-record it then?
Yeah.
If it's yeah, live, well, then let's mess around.
Yeah. Joe Lycett always said to me that he loves Sunday Brunch. You've got 3 hours to mess about and entertain and just have fun. And then he, I remember him coming on and saying, I can't believe how many tickets I sold. It was because 3 hours long on a Sunday morning, just selling your wares. Right, next question. What's the best moment of your career?
Great. Yeah. So the bits that I enjoy the most a lot with stand-up is the work in progress stuff. It is working on a new show and those gigs where you realize, oh, I've got a show and this works. So there's always those moments. Every year when you're working on a new show, you'll have a preview or work in progress show where the show kind of clicks and you get really excited about it. And that's probably my favorite moment in stand-up a lot of the time. And then on the opposite end of that, it's when you finally film the show and release it. So, you know, when I got to release those shows on Netflix in 2018, that was a massive highlight. I got them exactly how I wanted them. And that was a huge highlight. And also, yeah, like I say, every show, whenever you have that work in progress show, when you realize, oh, I know what the show is and I've got it now. That's what I what you find yourself chasing, I think. I find myself chasing each time.
All right, what's the worst moment of your career?
Oh, boy. There's a lot.
Do you enjoy dying?
No. Well, sometimes you do.
Do you know
if
what?
You're in a good frame of mind.
I watched a few. I was watching some YouTube clips of you yesterday because I remembered you'd done some chat shows in America. Yeah. I wanted to find the one. I couldn't find where you'd basically shat your pants. Basically, I had the night before you had bad stomach or something the night before or something. Who was that? Was that Jimmy Fallon?
Conan.
Conan. Actually, that's really interesting because I watched you do James Corden. Mm-hmm. And he'd really hyped the audience up for you, hadn't he?
Yes.
And it was a brilliant gig. The Conan one I was watching, and I was watching, and it went okay, but I was watching you desperately trying to get the crowd. And it's like, I love watching comics when the act's not quite, and they're trying to bring the, and that's what you were trying to do, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, and that's one of the ones where you enjoy, like, I knew it was going badly, that one. Like, it wasn't going as well as, like, because those American chat shows, like you say, the Corden one is a better representation of what American chat shows are like. So the audience are really amped so much of the time. And this audience for Conan, just the whole show, they hadn't really been very vocal. And I was like, oh dear, this could be difficult for me. And so I went on knowing that it might be hard. And then when it was hard, I just kind of found it funny because I was like, this is going on TV. It's going to make so little sense to people. I'm this English guy doing a very kind of, I've got a very British sense of humor, and like in front of an audience where it's not quite working, this is going to be hilarious. And so that I enjoyed that. There were other gigs where you really, you know, you really wanted it to go well, or sometimes when it's just like, you know, you've gone out, you've traveled further than you would for like a work in progress show or something. And then you get there and then the audience don't like it and you've got a really long, you know, drive ahead of you to get home. But I you just feel like, oh, this is my whole evening. But like, to be fair, all the low points now, I kind of aren't, when I look back at when I was an open spot, you know, there's a story that I told on Would I Lie to You about sleeping in a bush after a gig because I've missed my train and stuff like that. I mean, you've weirdly got the resilience because you're a young comic, you're hungry for, like, you're chasing this dream or whatever. And so you kind of are a bit more resilient to having a gig that wasn't great in a little pub, missing your train, having no money, your phone dying, sleeping in a bush all night, and then getting the train at 6 the next morning and feeling like shit. But like, you kind of like, well, this is part of me I'm chasing my dream. No one ever said that was easy. I think if that happened to me now, if I had that same situation now, I would have a break. I'd literally be in tears and I'd have a full meltdown because I'd be like, why have I not got my life on track yet?
Wasn't there some gig you were doing, a charity gig? It was in my notes on the last Sunday brunch you did it, and you did some joke which went down badly. Was it some sort of, it was like a cancer charity or something. What was it? Do you know? No, don't worry about it.
Well, there's been some gigs where it's like, you've got some gigs where you do charity gigs and mess them up. I've had very awkward, you know, gigs like that.
When you die on stage, Bill Burr always says, when you die as a comic, you've got to come out your act, try and work the room before you go back in it. You obviously can't do that if you're on an American chat show. But is that what you do? Do you come out your act, try and get them going, and then go back in?
Sometimes, but I have to say, one of the things, for every comic, it's different. And for me, I shouldn't do that. And when I do it, it ruins it because I'm in my act, and my act is different. Bill Burr is pretty similar. The persona is the same off and on stage.
Yeah.
You know, so he can come out of his act and he's still Bill Burr, but he's just referencing how the gig's going. And you're like, oh, it's the same consistent persona. It just feels a bit looser and we can maybe bring you back in a bit easier. With me, I'm being very weird and obtuse on stage a lot of the time. And then if I come out of it, which I have multiple times, and reference how the gig's going badly, and I speak more like I'm speaking to you now, the audience are like, what's going on? And either it makes it worse and they're like, well, where's that comic gone that we were watching a minute ago? Or it makes it better and then they don't want the act. So then when you try and go back into the act, they're like, no, go back to that guy earlier on. We preferred him. So, and sometimes, you know, I try and reference that it's going badly because I think that everyone's aware that it's going badly. And then I've misread the room, and they're just a quiet audience. They don't think it's going bad. Yeah. And then they're like, oh, what, is this going badly or something? And then they feel like they're getting told off, or they feel like, you know, especially with my last show was all about, like, it's a lot about my mental health. And if I thought a gig was going bad and I came out of it and referenced it going badly, it was even worse, because they would think, oh, this is like, he's clearly not coping very well. He's struggling with his mental health again. And you're like, no, that's not what's going on. But like, okay, now I've got this on my hands as well. So like, yeah, it's best for me not to do that. However, I can't emphasize enough, I never learn my lessons when it comes to stand-up. And I always make the same mistakes over and over again, just slightly better versions of them.
All right, we've only got through four questions. We've got 19 minutes to go. So just very quickly on America, is that a big plan of yours? How's it going? Because obviously you've done the chat shows, you've got Netflix now, which the Americans can see. I know we're in the middle of lockdown at the moment, but is an ambition to break America big time?
No, it's not. Like it's been a nice bonus that I didn't expect. But no, it's not a long-term thing to break America. I love gigging in America. I love traveling around there and doing live shows there. I'm very proud of like having been able to do the chat shows and have the Netflix specials out. But in general, I'm just trying to, you know, every year you come up with a bunch of different projects, be it a live show, mm-hmm. book, something scripted, whatever it is, and you just find the best home for it and you do it there and you do it in the space where you're going to be given the most freedom. So yeah, at the minute, if America is the best place for something, I'll do it there. Otherwise, yeah, I'm fine.
All right, next question. Gonna have to bash through a few of these. What's the key to a good relationship? Can be work, can be partners, friends, family, whatever.
I think just, it's tricky, I guess. You both have to care enough about each other to kind of like, it's all that like patience and forgiveness, and just being able to be yourself around someone as well. Being relaxed enough around them, and you don't feel like you're on edge and trying to be a different version of yourself for them all the time. I think that's essential. And being able to say whatever you like to each other without upsetting each other too much as well. That's the difficult thing sometimes. But we've all learned a lot of lessons, haven't we, from past relationships, especially like, you know, romantic ones or whatever. And like you learn how you need to be in relationships and tweak that a bit more, but you also learn what you need from other people and tweak that. I'd say just you know you're in a good relationship with someone when you're relaxed enough to be yourself, and so are they. Perfect. That's what you want.
All right, what group are you or were you part of? This can be anything. I assume you might go down the band route, but you know, it could be a fan club or something or anything else, or a political movement.
What group would I want to be a part of?
No, what were you or are you? I mean, I suppose the easiest one is to talk about your bands. How many bands were you in?
I was in Pin Drop when I was 15. We were a new metal band. I was in the new hardcore skiffle movement. I was in Three Line Whip. I was in the Wow Scenario. I was in the Capri Sun Quartet. And loved all of them. Loved being in bands. But then, as I said earlier, I really liked the change of suddenly being on my own and doing stuff just as a comic. And I mean, now it's funny to talk about groups, because like lockdown and this year and stuff has really highlighted how much, you know, maybe I don't always love being in groups, and I quite like just chilling out with one or two people. So yeah, I mean, in terms of groups now, I don't know. I mean, yeah, a band would be fun, but like I'm doing a music thing at the minute, but it's like over the internet with people, so we're all working together remotely, and maybe that's my favorite way.
With who? Who are you doing it with?
A lot of musicians that I'm a big fan of, and I've met over the years, and like so some, you know, some rappers, some singers, jazz drummers, indie rock guitarists, and just like doing a very weird and fun kind of experimental album that I think it's very poppy as well in parts, and I'm just having fun doing that. It's like it's been a really fun obsessive project during this year, because you're sitting around at home.
Are you singing?
No, you... don't worry. I played the drums on it, and I'm essentially producing it.
When's it out?
Oh, no idea. Once I get everything from everybody, which is going to take ages,
Right.
And then once we've mixed it, you know, so it's going to take a long time to finish it. But, you know, every week I'll wake up some mornings and get a little, you know, something in my Dropbox from one of the musicians. And that's a new thing to add to the songs. And then I can play around with that for a few days on my computer and then get another one at some point. So yeah, it's just, it's been so much fun.
I've got to say, James, I'm watching you here on Zoom. Your face is lit up talking about that. Clearly something you love.
Yeah. I do love it. I mean, it's also something that I'm aware that, you know, whenever you hear someone who's not, you know, who is known for doing one thing, talk about doing another, you think, oh, maybe that'd be shit. So like, I'm also laughing because I know how it would sound to other people. But I can't wait to eventually put it out there.
I can't wait to hear that. Right, what's your outstanding fashion moment? It could be bad or good.
Well, I used to for years. So when again going back to stand up. When I was at Open Spot, one of the breakthroughs was dressing a different way. And I started always wearing, I found that if I wore slacks, shoes, smart shoes, a polo shirt and a jumper over the top of it, my gigs went better. And so I just bought loads of that and just kept on buying those outfits. But because I didn't have much money, that was all I owned. So outside of gigs, that was all I was wearing. And I hated it. And I was like, I really didn't like, you know, and some there's the other comics who would kind of get annoyed at me. That like, they're like, honestly, you're wearing that off stage as well. Like, you look ridiculous. And I remember having a moment. It was after a breakup in 2013. And I was walking from my flat to the tube station. And I just looked down at what I was wearing. And I thought, I hate this. I absolutely hate this outfit. And then, to be fair, I went from one obsession to another, and I decided I'm going to throw out all these clothes, I'm going to buy new ones, and I just bought loads of autumnal corduroy. And suddenly I was wearing corduroy trousers all the time and autumnal like shirts and stuff, and it was all like, yeah, reds and greens and yellows and browns, and for a few years, you know, just dressed like that until the specials came out on Netflix, and then I just started being a bit more like, do you know what, maybe don't be as strict with what you wear, and have a costume for each show that you do, and then off stage wear whatever you like. And that was definitely a big moment where I kind of went, yeah, okay, for this next show I'm wearing a tracksuit top and black trousers and shades, and off stage I'm not gonna dress like that all the time. I don't have to have my off stage out wardrobe dictated by my on stage wardrobe.
It's weird because you don't think about it, but comics eventually have to choose what they're going to look like and their image and their persona, and they have to go with it. So, you know, Russell Howard is like t-shirts, isn't he? That's it. Mm-hmm. T-shirts, jeans, and then Russell Kane, smart suit. So he's got to wear a smart suit every time he goes out on stage.
But then he didn't used to. But then that was a conscious. So that's always fun when a comic does a conscious change like that. And you know, for years, you know, Russell Kane was t-shirts and stuff like that. And then he just made the switch and was like, no, I'm going to dress like this now on stage. And
you all talk to each other behind the scenes. You all go, oh, what are you doing? Why are you wearing the suit? And do you see each other a lot?
Sometimes, yeah. When it's your mates and you've been gigging with each other a lot, and then you do a gig with them, and they, you know, if it's not a work in progress and like you see their new show and they're dressed in a certain way, yeah, you might comment on that. And it's fun to notice when someone starts doing something different. And what's actually funny is people not talking to the person themselves, but when you hear it from somebody else and they're like, have you seen such and such lately? They've started doing this or wearing this. It's actually really interesting. And then you get excited to see this new act that someone's got. And I like that a lot.
All right. What do you do to keep fit? Next question.
At the minute, I am, because at the start of lockdown, the first lockdown, I went really hard on this whole, like, you know, this kind of prison workout in my living room, but then messed my knees up. So now I'm doing half an hour yoga, which I've never done yoga before this year. So I do like yoga each morning. I do 20 to 30 minutes of hula hooping, which I learned for Taskmaster. So like for Taskmaster, I had to do hula hooping for a task.
Yeah, but you mucked it up at the end.
I mucked it up right at the end, and then I showed them that I was really good at it afterwards, but I panicked. I completely panicked. And but, you know, they genuinely gave us the hula hoops to practice with at home. So again, yeah, during lockdown, I was like, well, I've got this. I'll utilize that. And then I've got some resistance bands, which I'm doing like some very simple like arm stuff with. And then I'll try and go for a walk for an hour each day.
I love Taskmaster. It's been one of my things that in lockdown, I'd watched it, but I'd watched it sporadically. And I just went from series one, I've watched the whole lot, binge watched it all. Because you just all made me laugh. Your series is a particularly good series, isn't it? Fantastic.
I loved it so much. And it's like, it was a show that like you, I've watched all of it. And going on a show when you've watched it so much as a fan and you've been a fan of it is so exciting, especially when it's Taskmaster. And it's like, you know, first time I went on Would I Lie to You, I was so excited because I hadn't missed an episode of that.
I'd love to do that.
But you do one episode and then you're gone, and then until you come back again. But Taskmaster, you know you're there for the whole series. And I remember the first day when they drive you to the house and you go through the gate and you see the house in like real life. And it was so exciting and I couldn't wait. And you'd get disappointed when they, because you'd be sat in a little room on your own and they'd come and get you for each task. And you'd be disappointed each day when they went, okay, last one. And you'd be like,
Those shows suit you, don't they? Would I Lie to You really suits you. You and Bob Mortimer, and Bob Mortimer's great on Taskmaster as well. Those shows suit both of you. For some reason, you really excel at the both of them, don't you?
I really love doing them. And I think maybe that's a part of it a lot of the time, is if the comics enjoying themselves or the panelists are enjoying themselves, you just can tell and it is fun to watch them. And yeah, I just love Would I Lie to You? You know, I had a lot of true stories that, like, because I don't do true stories as part of my stand-up, so it's really fun to kind of be able to use them there. And then Taskmaster, you know, it really, you have to improvise, and I really love, you know, the improv quality of it. So similar as like when you're on Sunday brunch or whatever, you just have to go with your first idea, whatever's in your head at the time, and just run with that. And that's really fun, the kind of seat of your pants stuff.
Yeah. All right. How's your mental health? Next question.
Lovely question. all right, actually. Like, I've actually found, like, you know, it's only the last few years I've started to kind of like acknowledge and look at my mental health. I think for years it was something that I just ignored. And I think because people see it as quite a scary thing. It's weird because it's something that we've all got. But then we see it as something that if you talk about mental health, then something must be wrong with you. And you know, you're talking about something being wrong rather than just something that all of us have gotten. You know, if you talk about physical health, you don't get scared necessarily. Maybe some people do. But like, at the minute, it's good. And it's good because in the last few years, I've started to acknowledge it more and be like, okay, like I was saying earlier, you know, okay, I feel nervous before I go on stage. And that's an immovable fact. And ignoring it isn't going to do me any good, but acknowledging it is always means I have a better gig and I feel better before I go on. If I acknowledge myself, oh, I'm feeling nervous right now or anxious or I'm feeling a bit stressed today. And I feel like obviously like last year I was on a massive tour for most of the year. I was gigging all year in different countries and that was very stressful and I didn't give myself enough time off. My agent tried to give me time off and was like, come on, James, let's take some more days off here. And I was like, no, I'll be fine. I'll be absolutely fine. And then it was a bit too much for me. And this year has obviously been the opposite, you know, for all of us and for better or for worse. And I've been very, very lucky this year that, you know, worked a lot last year and I'm able to work from home this year. And so I'm not in front of audiences every single night. I'm not having that happen each evening. And I found that as a result, I've been able to, really de-stress, decompress. And, you know, people talk about self-care a lot, but like we were saying earlier with the exercise, I can dedicate a bit more time to that each day and then relax in the evenings as well. So, yeah, at the minute it's good. And I have a therapist who I see every fortnight and they're fantastic. And I found that incredibly helpful as well.
You know, you're really making me think here. It's interesting because maybe 10, 15 years ago, you might not have gone, I've got a therapist, unless you're American. You know, it's not something that people would definitely talk about. My listeners know because this is the reason why I started the podcast is my mental health can be problematic for me. Mm-hmm. I've been through a series of periods in my life where I've been very depressed, very dark. But I remember when I first did it on TV and I was depressed. I always never used to tell anyone. I used to hide it and just turn up, do the show. I'm never depressed when I'm doing the show, by the way. I always feel really alive when I'm doing a TV show, so before and afterwards. And I feel terrible about it. but I would never tell anyone because I would think I might lose my job. Now, I think if I told people, if I was going through a really bad time and I told people, I think it would mean that I was unsackable. it's totally changed, hasn't it? It's like, you know, this is the way it's gone. So
people are it's good and people seem more aware of it now and more kind of, and also just like, you know, because it doesn't, we've got this habit and it still is lingering, there's still people, we're not there yet, you know, people are still, I found by doing a show that ended up being about my mental health, it wasn't like I deliberately went out to write a stand-up show about mental health. I was doing a show about a tough year in my life where things were stressful, and it just becomes about mental health because that's part of it. And I was surprised at how many audiences or how many audience members didn't respond to that very well, would heckle during a bit about mental health, about having suicidal thoughts or something like that, and would do quite a base level inconsiderate heckle during that moment. And even people sometimes who would, like I say, you'd come out of a gig that didn't go very well, and then they would make it about your mental health. They'd make it about, you know, you'd see on Twitter the next day, people going, he's not doing all right, everybody. We all need to look out for him. He's not doing okay. And kind of being a bit gaslighty in that sense. And we are still a long way from people fully understanding that, you know, it's a very normal thing. You know, we've all got mental health to keep on top of in one way or another. And
I don't think we understand it either. Yeah. I mean, I've gone from starting this podcast going, I suffer from depression, to refusing to use the word suffering, because I think I think there's something I can do about it. And I think there's a lot of things, like I realize I'm addicted to my phone. I realize fatigue is one of the things, poor diet, all those things. If I do too much, my mental health starts wavering a bit. So there are but I also understand that if I do 6,000 press-ups, my arms are going to hurt. So I've got to work out what it is which is making me feel the way I feel. And I spend so long on it. And this is, as I say, the podcast has been invaluable to me. It really has helped me. I've learned so much about doing things like, you say, yoga in the morning. I don't do yoga, but I do a stretching routine, and I do my cold showers from Wim Hof. I do lots of things. So, and I think we're just trying to understand now. We all know technology is not good for us mentally. Mm-hmm. And the idea that, you know, I've tried my hardest in lockdown this time to not watch about the American elections and the pandemic and everything else. Because it just, I'm not sure as a human we're able to take it all on board, all that information and all the news. And so much of it is bad, as we know. So anyway, it is what it is. Let's move on to the next question. When was the happiest you've ever felt?
Oh, that's a nice question, isn't it? It's difficult, really. I mean, I don't want to get too mushy or what, but like the last kind of over a year and a half now of this current relationship I'm in, there's been like, you know, that's, you know, my relationship with her is the happiest I've ever felt. And there's been, even though, like, you know, 2020 has been a bad year in general for the world and it's been very hard, you know, some of the moments this year of just, you know, we live together now, and some of the moments just chilling out in the flat with her. I'd just say that, really. I mean, I don't think there's anything else career-wise that would even come close to that. So, yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it? Life is a one-player game, as we all know. You come in on your own, you go out on your own. But actually, it's the partnerships and the relationships and people you meet along the way are the stuff which makes you probably happier. So I know we're all supposed to be making ourselves happy, but actually interaction with other humans is what makes you, what really ticks the box, doesn't it, with the happiness?
Yeah, but only if, like, it's that thing of, like, I was only able to be in this relationship once I'd liked I had to like myself first, and before I could like anyone else, and love myself before I could love anyone else. Like, it was that thing of like, one of the major things I noticed, and going back to mental health, is how I was going into past relationships with a bad relationship with myself. And so therefore, you know, it's hard to then have a good relationship with somebody else.
Well, so you didn't like yourself?
Yeah. And like, I just like, sometimes that's because, you know, your confidence gets knocked after a breakup, say. Yeah. And then you need to restore that confidence after that breakup and get, because you can convince yourself that this person didn't want to be with me. That means I'm, you know, not unlovable. That's quite an extreme term, but like, you know, that person didn't like me. So maybe I'm not, there's things that are wrong with me. And until you wrestle with that and reckon with it and come back to like, actually I'm all right actually. And I'm not a dickhead. I just wasn't very well suited to that person and she wasn't well suited to me. So it's fine. And then you like, you know, come out of your shell a bit, feel a bit more comfortable with yourself, like yourself. And I used to have like, not deliberately, but I used to have like quite a long time between relationships, about 2 years. And like the first year was kind of me getting over that person. And the second year was me liking myself again. And then I'd meet someone and feel ready to be in a relationship again. And I didn't know that I was deliberately doing that, but I just wasn't getting in a relationship if I didn't feel like ready for one. And but then there's some times, you know, in recent years where I've not done that and got into a relationship before I like myself again. And they've inevitably just not been the, you know, the best version of me that I could, because like I've been insecure. I've had a lot of self kind of like hate and whatever going on. So not that good to be in a relationship with.
Yeah.
So yeah, other people do make you happy, but only if you make you happy as well.
Yeah, I've had that before, James, and I always think the way to conquer lack of confidence is to establish your values again, work out what your values are, because that's important. And if your values are good and wholesome, which I believe mine are, and probably yours are as well, you can start, you know, getting a base, and then you conduct yourself well. And then you can start being proud of yourself at night and go, yeah, I'm all right, actually, because I'm conducting myself well, and I'm proud of my values. I'm not an asshole. And I think the problem is if you get caught up in trauma and anger, this is really deep, by the way, but you get caught up in it's too easy to go online and go, fuck Trump. I hate Trump. Here's another meme of Trump. And it's like, hold on, what are you saying? You're saying you're damaged. He's gone. Let it go. You know, I hate this lot. I hate them. I do know. And when you're feeling that you want to go on and throw hatred around social media and stuff, I think that's the time to really look in and go, hold on a second. Yeah, am I conducting myself well here? You know, let's go back to my values and what I believe in and stuff like that, and try and get it back. That's just my belief anyway, and the way that I try and deal with lack of confidence.
I think there's definitely stuff in that. I mean, like it's difficult. I mean, I'm not on social media at all now. And like, you know, a lot of it is just definitely that doesn't make you feel good. And it really does, especially with stuff like Trump. I mean, you know, he is, and you know, has been for a long time, such a person where like, you know, he puts a lot of hate out into the world. And so it's very, very difficult not to see what he says and have that reaction backwards.
Yeah, but the way to beat that is compassion, always. Oh, look, we're really really going down a line.
Sure, but then there's that thing of like, it's very easy for, I guess, people like me and you to talk about that, you know, straight white men who aren't in his crosshairs, you know. And so therefore, when you do see some of the stuff he says and the impact that it has, it is very difficult to react to it in a way that's balanced, especially when, you know, for a long time people have tried to respond in compassionate or reasonable ways and it hasn't worked because him and his followers and people like them, because I'll just face it, they're nothing new, don't respond to that, don't listen to that. And so it's like that whole thing that some people say of like, well, we asked nicely and you didn't do anything, so now we're doing this. And
And also we've got a problem over here because you can just lie and you can say anything you like and just nothing happens to you anymore. And this seems to be the latest trend with politics: say what you want, do what you want. And so you're right, compassion kind of,
well, that's when you go like, man, so some of those things you go like, could I have been living my life like this all the time? Could I just walking around and saying to people, yeah, I did brilliant in that gig, I absolutely smashed it. You died on your ass, I smashed that gig and you all gave me a standing ovation. No, we didn't. You were getting walkouts. No, everyone was standing up and saying I was the best. Next gig.
Right, let's get through another couple of these questions. What's it like to be famous?
It is, I don't know, really, because I don't know how... I mean, I'm sure you're the same. Like, you know, viewing yourself as famous is a very odd thing, and thinking, am I that? Would I qualify as that? I'd say that I really love people who like my stand-up coming to see my stand-up, and that is brilliant. So selling those tickets and getting like-minded people onto the gigs is great. And sometimes you meet people outside of, you know, gigs or whatever, you know, out and about in public, who are really nice and who really get it, and, you know, will come up and say that they liked a thing you did, and that means a lot. And that's really nice. The flip side of it is that you also get members of the public who feel like they can just say whatever they like to you, and they're quite rude. And sometimes even, like, you know, you feel a bit like assaulted by what they've done or come up to you and done. And that side of things isn't always great. When you get to see, you know, I don't get to see my family that much because I don't live in the same part of the country as them. Sometimes, you know, go home, go out for a meal for my mum's birthday meal or something, and all my family around a table in a pub, and someone comes up to you when you're mid-meal having a chat with your family and goes, James, come have a photo with my daughter, and they say stuff like, it'll only take 5 minutes, come on, like that. I take a second of your life, mate, come on, like that, like almost like you're being unreasonable if you say no. Those things are a bit unpleasant, and those things make you feel like, oh, like, you know, I just want to sit down with my family and have a nice time, or I want to, you know, have a bit of a quiet day today. And so, you know, there are pluses and minuses, but I think you learn to negotiate them. Coming off of Twitter and coming off of social media was a part of that. You go, okay, there's a lot of stuff on social media that I don't like as a consequence of being in the public eye. And so therefore, what I can't expect is for them to change. They're not going to stop giving me, you know, tweeting whatever they want to me or whatever, or making up rumors about me or whatever it is. So, but what I can control is if I see it or not, and I can just remove myself from that and I don't have to see it anymore. And it's kind of the same with everything in general with it. I think, well, I can decide how many gigs I do, so how overwhelmed I am by stuff and how stressed or busy I am. So I can control that, so I've got to control it. And I can control how I react to people who come up to me on the street as well.
You know? Do you have social media though, and run by your management, or
no?
See, I think that's where we're going to go. I've said this for a long time. It's just easier if you keep your family, you keep your social media, keep your fan base, and just let someone else do it, so they have to listen to all the horrific stuff that comes at you. It's just because it's a good form of data. It's a good database, isn't it? It's a good way to promote the stuff you're doing and the gigs you're doing.
It is. I wanted to kind of experiment with just like losing it altogether, so I didn't have to engage with it at all. And so far, that's been absolutely fine. And nothing. There's been no consequences, and I'm not always sure that it is as useful as we think it is. Obviously, for decades, it wasn't there at all. No one used it, and people were doing fine and had careers. Yeah. And I actually feel like there's maybe a certain point where it's useful, when like not many people know who you are. You're not, you know, necessarily. If you do something, it's not getting advertised in many places, so it's quite good to tweet about it and have that presence so that the fans you have got know what you're doing. But once I kind of got to a point where I wasn't having to do that as much, it wasn't as dependable on it, I was like, there's really no other point being on here, because otherwise it just means that every day, because people kind of go, well, just focus on the good stuff that you get on there or whatever. But then also I think that's a bad impulse. It's kind of, you know, say I have a good gig, I just want to walk away from that having a good gig. And I know I've had a good gig. I know I enjoyed it. Just the act of going on Twitter to see what people said about you immediately taints the good experience you had, because you're needing this confirmation from Twitter. And even that, even if every single tweet is saying you were brilliant that night, I don't like that I'm going on now that I need that in any way. So now if I have a good gig, that's it. I just had a good gig and I walk away from the gig and I'm not there looking for validation anywhere else. And that feels healthier. So I think like everything about it really is everything about it feels unhealthy. There's every now and again, you have a moment on there that is fun and that's good. But a lot of the time, even if it's not directly at yourself, you can see something that stresses you out.
It's the thing I was talking about earlier, and I used Trump as an example, which is a poor example, but someone who goes, James A. Castro, I saw you tonight, you were shit or whatever.
Yeah.
It's not about you, is it? It's about them.
Yes.
That they could be asked. That's someone who's lacking confidence or he's got trauma in them that they can be asked to do that. Because I don't ever go on social media and slag anyone off. I don't even slag any politicians or anyone off, because I just don't see the need for doing it. And I just think that's when you've got your confidence down, or you've got trauma. You think, there's someone I can have a go at. And I've explained this to a few of my celebrity friends. I don't have many. It's like, stop thinking it's about you. It's not about you. It's they don't know. Because if you meet that person who slags you off in the street, they go, hey, James, I love you. You're funny. Because they just get to meet the celebrity. It's like, it's only at that moment they go, this is how I can outpour my rage. And, you know, and so I think you're really right, by the way, on social media. I don't know if you're aware of this. Chris Evans, the DJ Chris Evans, he doesn't have a mobile phone. He has a landline. And I'm so jealous, because I just think, oh my God, that must be amazing just to go through life without being attached to this bloody thing. But
I mean, it's mad thinking of how things used to be. But yeah, carry on.
James, you know, we're never going to get through all these questions, but one of the big ones here, have you ever seen a ghost or a UFO?
But there was a point when I was a kid where I thought I'd seen a ghost, where something happened. I heard something downstairs in the middle of the night, and I went out to the upstairs to the landing, and you could look down into this room downstairs from the landing, and I saw a light moving across the bookshelves and kind of scanning the bookshelves, and thought there were burglars in the house, and then woke up my parents and no one was in the house. Now, looking back, they were probably outside in the garden shining a torch into our house, and it was going through the screen door. That is what happened. But at the time, I was convinced that it must have been something, if no one was in there, because I was convinced someone was in the house.
Do you believe me? Because I'm desperate. 2020, I was thinking this could be the year aliens land, or we find out. I really want to see aliens or ghosts or something. I've never seen any, and I can't believe in them because I haven't seen any of it. But do you believe in ghosts or aliens visiting us?
I don't believe in ghosts. Aliens is one of those things where, like, you know, the universe is infinite, and so to say there can't be any life out there at all.
Yeah, but visiting us at the moment.
Visiting us, who knows? I mean, probably not. But, like, I mean, it'd be a laugh. Oh, I'll tell you, it'd be a laugh. If they're nice aliens, it'd be lovely. I mean, I don't know how the world would react. I can only imagine how the world would react if we go. I mean, the way that, you know, a lot of countries react when just, you know, someone from a neighbouring country moves over is bad enough, let alone if someone from another galaxy came over. I don't know how well the Trumps of the world would react to that. I'd probably quite like to see an alien or a ghost. Maybe it'd be fun to kind of try and believe in something that's explain.
I'd hate to die and then the year after the aliens landed, and even if they destroyed us, I'd have liked to watch
that. Yeah, you'd be gutted. Yeah.
Do you have any daily routines, James A. Custer?
I've spoken about this on a few podcasts, but every morning I splash cold water in my face because I listened to Jerry Seinfeld getting interviewed by Alec Baldwin, and he said that he saw a film where, I think it was Paul Newman wakes up and splashes his face with cold water in the morning. And he saw that and thought, oh, that's great. That's a good way to wake up. And so every morning, Jerry Seinfeld gets up and splashes his face with cold water. And so then I thought, that sounds good. So then I did it. And it does, it's like, you know, I guess similar to your cold showers thing, but like a much, much lighter version of that. Just splash your face with cold water, and it does, like, this makes you feel, this wakes you up a bit. And I do just, you know, it just makes me feel better than if I don't do it. Has that effect.
I had a therapist who said to me, one of the most important things you can do in the morning is get up and immediately splash cold water in your face, because it wakes you up and then you're all go. And I've never done it, so maybe I should try and do it.
It's great. And also, like, I always end up thinking about so many different people when I'm doing it, because I end up thinking about Jerry Seinfeld and I end up thinking about Paul Newman. So I end up thinking about Jerry Seinfeld, thinking about Paul Newman. And also, I told my friend Ellis James to do it and he started doing it. And also there's a comedian called John Robbins who does a show with Ellis James, who had this kind of bit that he did on the show about seeing listening to Johnny Vaughan say about something that he did in the shower every morning. Like, I don't know if it might have been a cold shower thing. And and how therefore every time he's in the shower, John thinks about Johnny Vaughan. And so now I think about all of those different people whenever I'm splashing cold water in my face. It's that kind of that conversation. Now I think about you.
Well, if you ever take a cold shower, think about me naked taking a cold shower. Let's put
yeah,
that in your mind.
Always.
Have you tell our listeners something that has been life changing for you? Could be an event, a teacher, someone, something happening.
Yeah, well, there's a few kind of different things. Definitely the, maybe they haven't changed my life because I was thinking about like car crashes that I've had and stuff, but they haven't really been, they've more kind of like, you know, I don't know, affirmed or confirmed what I wanted to do anyway, which is like continue following like, you know, a creative career.
How many car crashes have you been in?
3 different car crashes that have all been my fault that have resulted in the car being written off each time and progressively worse each time. But I mean, the first one was probably the most life-changing one, and it was the most like the least dramatic one because I just kind of span on some mud on a back road at night and the car went up a verge and smashed into a hedge and I'm off the verge again and all this. And it was a write-off, but it was a Ford Fiesta, and you know, so it didn't take much to write it off. But like, there was a moment where the car kind of smashed off this hedge and went in the air and landed on the 2 right-hand wheels and was kind of like just like teetering there for a little bit. And it felt like forever. And then it went back on 4 wheels. And after that, I remember thinking like how, because I knew that if the car had rolled onto its roof, it wouldn't have rolled. It would have just like just gone and, you know, I could have snapped my neck or whatever. It could have been pretty bad. And there's also a few other things like, you know, some cars came around the corner after the crash that if they'd come around a bit earlier, they probably would have hit me and, you know, all this stuff. And I started, and back then I was still probably... This was just outside, just between Kettering and a village called Geddington on these back roads.
All right, I've got this theory now. I've just come up with it because you're telling me this. I've been in 2 really quite bad car crashes. And one, I ended up in a river and the water started coming into the car. But not like up to my head. It was a shallow river, but it came up and we were getting our feet wet. And the other one, I ended up in the front room of somebody's house. Went off the road. And both times I was like, wow, that's interesting. But they happened because I lived out in Hertfordshire and there's all country lanes and there's roads like that. London, I don't think you could do it in a major city because I don't think, I suppose people do hit lampposts and stuff, but those sort of car crashes happen out there, don't they? The what sort of ones where you end up hitting verges and stuff.
Well, definitely country roads are like, you know, you've got to be, I mean, I've 2 of my car crashes have been on country roads and another one has been on a dual carriageway. But like, yeah, I mean, you've got to be careful on those roads. They are very treacherous. And like, but like, yeah, I think that, I mean, that car crash definitely changed my whole life because it kind of, for one, it started me, it was the start of me kind of, losing my faith is quite a dramatic term, but slowly kind of like maybe questioning the faith that I've been raised in and eventually kind of like moving away from it. Because I was thinking a lot about, you know, death and dying and stuff like that, and just about what I actually think happens and what I, you know, think about the, you know, life in general, I guess. And also, as a result of it, that was when, you know, so I had that car crash, had the kind of like crisis about dying, started doing the bucket list stuff, which led to me doing stand up for the first time, which is now my career. And to be fair as well, the second car crash I had, which was at the end of the band that I was in, so that Wow Scenario band that you mentioned earlier, we did our final ever gig. And on the way home, I fell asleep on a dual carriageway and we had this crash. And a similar thing to the first car crash, but kind of reversed almost, I started to almost move back towards faith again and started thinking about like, I started feeling quite strongly, it's a very long story if I tell it all, but I started to feel quite strongly that I should go to Kenya and do like aid work and stuff. And had this whole kind of string of it. And I was trying to ignore that in my head and didn't want to think about that. And then I had a string of experiences where I ended up going to talk to a vicar about this thing because I felt like it was like a calling. And he kind of told me, well, it probably wasn't a calling. And and they don't really need you in Kenya. You're just going to be eating more food than anyone else does out there, and it'll be all for yourself more than for the people of Kenya. So probably don't do that. And then I kind of like, and he also said, I mean, I don't want to give him too much credit here. He also said, like, I've seen you do one of your stand-up gigs and I thought that was good, so maybe pursue that instead. I didn't then pursue stand-up because he had told me to, but I kind of didn't go to Kenya and didn't, like, do all that stuff because of that chat. I didn't pursue it as much anyway. And I did just start doing stand-up because I didn't have any other, you know, any other options at that. But I just thought, oh, I might as well just do that. Because I didn't want to, because I'd had that second car crash, I really didn't want to go like, okay, well, I'll just get an office job or I'll do something, you know, safer. You know, I just had this second near-death experience and I just thought, I can't do something safe. I need to do something that's...
So you felt they were near death? Because when I had a car crash, I just thought, everything just went slow motion a couple of times I've had them. Yeah. And then I just thought, wow, that was interesting. And then I didn't think it was near death, even though they were quite horrific.
I think yours were near death. I mean, like, you don't need to be, like, injured and stuff. People go through the front of people's houses in their car and they die. And people, like, crash into rivers in their car and they die. And so those are things where what the car crashes really did for me and made me kind of, like, I mean... I can't even say did for me, really. They're just very scary afterwards because you just realise you're alive through sheer luck, sheer fluke, and that is it. And people have had car crashes that aren't as bad as yours and have not been as lucky and worse than yours and all this kind of stuff. And it's not anyone, you know, if you're like me and you have a lot of like religious friends and family, you know, you do have people saying to you, someone's looking out for you, but you absolutely can't feel that way when you look at the way the world is, when you look at people who absolutely don't deserve it, unjustly dying in car crashes.
So are you religious now or not?
No, I'm not. No. And it was one of the things that just made me go like, oh, life is just chaos in a bad way. And I'd say I'm agnostic. And you know, the reason I'm not religious is because I just think, you know, the way that organized religion is so regimented and so strict that none of them can be right. And we probably never, if there is something more than this life, we're probably not going to get to the bottom of it through any of those avenues. And I wouldn't even know where to begin to try and figure any of that stuff out. But definitely, yeah, those car crashes are just thinking like, yeah, all of them, I easily could have died in any one of those car crashes and but they did make me afterwards kind of make decisions based on the life I wanted to live rather than the safe option.
James, we've come to the end of the podcast. We didn't get through all 19 questions. However, I will let you have the bonus question anyway. This is the last question of the podcast. What is the meaning of life?
Ice cream.
I think I'm going to leave it there because I like that answer. James, thanks so much for doing this podcast.
Thank you,
man. I always love talking to you and I can't wait for you to come back on Sunday Brunch again. It's always, you're one of those people, I've said this to quite a few of my guests recently, but it's really true. When the name comes up on the email the week before the show and says who the guests are, whenever your name's on it, we're like, oh, brilliant. Because it means, it just genuinely means we've got good material. We've got 3 hours to fill and I love doing my show and I love it when I get a guest on that I know, right, I'm going to have some fun. And it's so it's always a pleasure having you on the show. Thanks for that. When are you next out on tour? You're not doing one for a while, are you?
I'm not doing one for a while. When does this podcast go out, actually?
In a couple of weeks.
So I'm not doing a tour. I'm not doing any live stuff. But on December the 17th, my last tour show is going to be live streamed on Dice, and people can watch it on there. People can buy tickets if you go to the Dice website. It's a 2-hour long show with an interval as well. The interval can last a minute or 20 minutes, depending on what you want to do. It's up to you. I'm really, really proud of it. And I even tell a little story about Sunday brunch in the show. And I may not do a joke about Tim Lovejoy.
Oh, okay.
It's a cheeky joke, to be fair, Tim. It's nothing I haven't said about you on your own show anyway.
James, thank you so much for doing this podcast. I'll see you soon, hopefully.
Thank you, Tim. It's been a pleasure as always.
Dear Lovejoy is written and hosted by Tim Lovejoy and produced by Blake Fellows. It's brought to you by Cooker, spelled Quooker. Check them out at cooker.co.uk. That's spelled Q-U-O-O-K-E-R. If you want to get in touch with Tim, email dearlovejoy@gmail.com. And Tim is on Twitter @TimLovejoy and on Instagram @TimLovejoy_official.